Good afternoon, everyone. The Early Learning and Elementary Education Subcommittee will now come to order. For the record, please remember to turn on your microphones for the roll call. Kirsten, please call the roll.
Chair Lupus.
Here.
Vice Chair Coster.
Here.
Ranking Member Davis.
Here.
Representative Caruso. Representative DeSegli.
Here.
Representative Duggan.
Here.
Representative Hawkins.
Here.
Representative Hunshofsky.
Here.
Representative Lamarca.
Here.
Representative Learned.
Here.
Representative McCurdy.
Here.
Representative Mooney.
Here.
Representative Nixon.
Here.
Representative Roach.
Present.
Representative Rodriguez.
Present.
Representative Tribolsi. Representative Trunow is excused. Representative Williams.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Kirsten. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Members, please remember to silence all electronic devices and be recognized by the chair before addressing the committee of the presenters. Committee, I am going to be playing the role of air traffic controller today because we have a number of members who are running out to present bills in other committees. All of you who are here for this committee for quorum call, you have an extra gold star this week. Those who decided that it was more important to present a bill than another committee before, you know, rather than being here for roll call, they'll have to deal with me later. But I'm being very serious. We're going to start with Representative Tant, then we're going to go into a presentation, and then we're going to come back to our final bill. So we're going to begin with HB 15, Children with Developmental Delays, by Representative Tant. Representative, you are recognized to explain the bill.
Thank you. And since I'm missing roll call on one of my committees, I appreciate you bringing me up first so I can skedaddle. So
Your gold star is in the office.
Yay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, and Ranking Member Davis. This bill brings Florida law in line with federal law as it relates to young students with disabilities. Federal law under IDEA for young students who are not meeting developmental benchmarks can be classified as developmentally delayed or not disabled and receive services to support them in educationally relevant settings up into age 9. Florida cuts that age at age 5. So what I'm trying to do, and some generous teachers, by the way, let teachers continue to get those services up to the last day that they are 5. Some don't. This will bring the age of Florida's law from 5 to age 9, or second grade, whichever comes first, bringing us in line with the federal IDEA. This will support more school children in our state, give educators and multidisciplinary assessment teams time to figure out what's actually going on with a young student. Those multidisciplinary teams are made up of a plethora of professionals among the school district personnel, including subject area leaders, school psychologists, behavioral therapists, speech and language pathologists, program administrators, occupational and physical therapists. Getting all of them in one room for an assessment is expensive and difficult. Under current statute, students tested at age even 3 or 4, who then become 6-year-olds a couple years later, have to be retested. There's almost always a break in service and another 6,000 to 7,000 per student test done. For those students who are not able to get the testing that they need, those students often repeat a grade that costs us a lot more money. This particularly impacts children with autism whose conditions are not easily diagnosed and children with learning disabilities who are falling through the cracks. This bill will allow for necessary supports to continue for these students and will be paid for through guaranteed ESE fundings, which is totals over $1 billion to Florida schools. And that, Mr. Chair, is the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Members, are there questions of the bill sponsor? Questions of the bill sponsor? All right, seeing none, we have quite a bit of public testimony, Representative. So we'll begin with James McFadden from Autism Speaks. Waving in support. Thank you, Mr. McFadden. Kathleen Murphy from the Florida PTA. Thank you, Ms. Murphy. Addison Davis from Hillsborough County Public Schools. Waving in support. Chadwick Leonard from the Florida Education Association. Waving support. Thank you, sir. Victoria Zepp, the Florida Coalition for Children. Thank you, Ms. Zepp. John Serra for the Florida Association of School Psychologists. Waving in support. Susan, I hope I get this right, Delage from, was I close? I wasn't even close. Delago, potato, potato. Delago from a teacher representing herself. Thank you so much for being with us, waving in support. Alice Nera, the Foundation for Florida's Future. Waving support, thank you. Lisa O'Rourke, a pre-K ESE VPK teacher. Before you speak, Ms. O'Rourke, we actually have a word for pre-K ESE VPK teachers in this committee. They're called angels.
Aw, thank you. Thank you so much. That's really appreciated.
You're recognized.
Thank you. It's so great to be here today to speak about this. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. I am a 14-year pre-K ESE VPK teacher in St. Johns County, Florida, and I am here to support this bill. And this is why. The transition from pre-K to kindergarten is a really tough one on our kiddos. So as a ESE pre-K teacher, having to drop that developmentally delayed label at age six or before age six is really tough because they will be starting kindergarten and we'll be sending them without the support that they need to reach those standards and to have that success in kindergarten. So postponing this age to nine will give them the gift of time. It'll give them the gift of time to bridge that gap, to meet those standards and have that support in their kindergarten classrooms. So I ask you, please vote yes for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mrs. O'Rourke. Members, that concludes public testimony. Is there debate on the bill? Ranking Member Davis, you're recognized.
Not really debate, just comments. Coming out of the classroom as a special education teacher, I really appreciate this. Reading this bill, there was some things about this that I didn't even know. Mm-hmm. So just to have Florida be able to still continue providing those necessary services for our development delayed children are great. And thank you to the 14-year VPK teacher, but I just wanted to say thank you to all of the organizations that are here today to support this bill. So thank you, Rep. Tant, for putting this bill forward, and thank you for the, to the organizations that are here to support it.
Thank you.
Representative McCurdy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tant, I also want to say thank you for bringing this bill. I'm happy to support it today. I'll be voting up. Just to know that we are currently missing a gap of children, and we can do something about it, and this body means a lot to me. And to know that we can allow instructors to, the opportunity to give the best support to more children is something that is very admirable. So thank you for bringing this good bill.
Members, any additional debate? All right. Representative Chance, I just want to thank you for your leadership on this. We've had a number of conversations. Mm-hmm. I just truly appreciate it. So with that, Representative Chance, you are recognized to close on your bill.
I just waved close. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tan. Kirsten, please call the roll. Members, make sure to turn on your microphones and record your vote.
Representatives Caruso. Davis.
Yes.
DeSegli.
Yes.
Duggan.
Yes.
Hawkins.
Yes.
Hanshofsky.
Yes.
Coster. LaMarca.
Yes.
Learned.
Yes.
McCurdy.
Yes.
Mooney.
Yes.
Nixon.
Yes.
Roach.
Yes.
Rodriguez, Trabulsi, Trunow is excused, Williams.
Yes.
Chair Lupus.
Yes.
13 yays, 0 nays.
Members, by your vote, HB 15 will be reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative Tam. All right, members, we're going to move into the presentation portion of our committee meeting today. Members, during committee weeks, we invited the Division of Early Learning to provide an update on the implementation of HB 419, which totally revamped the governance and accountability structure for our state's early learning programs, including VPK. In addition to the changes under HB 419, the division has also had the responsibility of distributing all of the federal funding relief that has come down over the last year. Through provider grants, teacher recruitment, retention initiatives, professional development, and public outreach and family supports, the division continues to play a significant part in helping childcare providers prepare students for kindergarten and keeping Florida open. This might be your third time in committee, sir. You have a starring role. We again have Chancellor Matt Mears for the Division of Early Learning, who's going to give us an update on the distribution of the CRSA dollars, the Coronavirus Response and Relief Supplement Appropriations Act. Chancellor, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair Lupus, and Ranking Member Davis. So I'm delighted to be here today, and this presentation goes in the extra good news column. There's been three major tranches of relief. The CARES program, which is the $223 million, is what came to our early care and education providers. The middle section that we're here to talk about today is the, we call CARISA, which is $635 million. And then the ARP stabilization, there's two pieces to that. The stabilization is 1.5, and then the ARP discretionary is $950 million. And if you were kind of in your car, the CARES and CARISA would be in the rearview mirror. Those have been awarded and are largely out the door, and the ARP stabilization is what's ahead. So we'll be talking about this CARISA bucket of $635 million. The things that have been done with it kind of break into, we've got it in sort of four categories. And so I'm just going to talk very briefly about each of these four categories to kind of give you a sense of the impact these funds have had. And you'll, as I look at this, for the math folks out there, you might add those up and say, wait, that doesn't add up to $635 million. There's a $30 million that has not been allocated. So that's not there. But 26% is to this first category of instructor relief payments. And then if you take the phase grants, that's about 62% of the money. And then we'll talk about some early learning initiative projects that were adopted through a budget amendment with the phase six grants. So this is a really exciting part of the program. And I guess the first thing to say is thank you very much, because you did this. I have, if I'm in my office, I pulled this off the window right next to my desk. This is the, from the General Appropriations Act last year, this is the language that appropriated $166 million to disaster relief payments. And so thank you very much. You did this. And now you can't all see this great. This is a picture of two early care and education professionals, and they are beaming. They have these huge smiles on their faces, and they're holding envelopes that they know contain $1,000 checks. So picture these two beaming early care and education professionals, and guess what? 76,000 checks like that went out. So take this two and multiply it to get to 76,000, and that's what the legislature has done by appropriating these funds for early care and education. You think, well, you know, what is $1,000? Well, the latest that there's national reporting on, the average wage for early care and education was $12.50 an hour. So $1,000 is 80 hours worth of work. But guess what? Which is better, $1,000 relief payment or 80 hours worth of work? Well, your 80 hours worth of work has taxes get taken out of it, whereas this emergency relief funds, all the dollars go directly to. And so if you think about, like, whatever layers of administration and, you know, from the Division of Early Learning and the Early Learning Coalitions and the providers and the frontline workers, 26% of the money went right to the pockets of our frontline early care and education professionals. And I know I mentioned it my first trip here. They are heroes and champions through the pandemic on the front lines. They kept Florida working. They kept the centers open. They watched the children of our first responders, our nurses, our physicians, the whole, you know, EMTs, policemen, firefighters. They're doing that work that allows everything else to go forward. So this is really exciting. Now, and here's some other great news. The wave one went out over the summer, and we kind of watched as people cashed the checks. And of course, a lot of people, like, the, you know, the checks they would hit like on a Friday and like over the weekend, like, you know, 20,000 checks cashed or something. And then there was kind of this pocket that weren't getting cashed, and we kind of reached out and said, well, what's, you know, some of these checks aren't being cashed. So some of these people, the checks came out in like September, October. Some of these people said, well, I don't want to cash it because I know I'd spend the money. I'm saving this for Christmas. This is going to be my Christmas money, you know, to have something really special this year. So this isn't just, oh, $1,000. This is something that really was a big, big thank you to people who truly deserved it. So I'm so proud of this. And the second wave, and we had an online app so people can apply. The Division of Early Learning worked with our partners at Ernst & Young that helped to build this. So you see the slide in the second window? It opened January 1st. And already, and this was a few days ago, we had 66,000. I just got the update. We're up to 77,300 providers, and 71,000 instructors have now applied. So our whole first wave, we had 76,000. Like, everybody but the last 5,000 have already put in their request for those second checks. So that's what kind of excitement and enthusiasm there is for this. So this first wave is going to, you know, have well over 70,000 checks that go out, and those have been super well received. So again, this is going back up in my office on the window. When I see this, I just smile, because these are people that are doing amazing work, and thankfully this legislature took the effort to thank them in a way that really meant a lot. Okay, so that's the disaster relief of payments. All that money straight to the pockets of our frontline early care and education professionals. The phase 5 and 6 grants, and I'm going to kind of sort of talk about them together, but just to kind of explain a couple of features of this, as the phases were put together based on the capacity of the early care and education centers. Of course, this was the first time we've done something like this, so it's hard to know exactly how many people will apply, and there's, you know, across a big state like Florida, there's changes in these things. But based on the capacity of the various facilities, there was a range of grants, and so those were issued and then could be used. And what I have that I'll share in a second are some feedback, just to give you a sense of how impactful these phase grants were. We gave out on this phase 5 grants, it's 8,700 providers have been awarded grants. That was May of 2021. And then about 6 months later came the phase 6 grants. We've had nearly 5,000 apply for those. And so you can see there's probably another about 3,000 that are still in the works that are drawing down these dollars. And I've just, again, just like the picture of those two smiling people holding their checks up, and I've waded through and I've just highlighted just kind of a sentence here and there out of a couple of these letters from the providers to give you a sense of how impactful this has been. This is a provider that says, we were able to set up monthly bonuses for our lead and assistant teachers. We were losing staff to other non-child care companies because of the hourly rates that others were able to give that we couldn't compete with, but I've been able to give these well-deserved bonuses. It says, we've been losing staff to Kroger's, Hobby Lobby, and Amazon. It's been very hard. So thank you for helping us continue the effort to provide quality child care for over 27 years. So this is, again, funds coming to someone trying to keep their workforce intact, having all kinds of competitive challenges in the marketplace with others, and saying these dollars are the thing that made a difference. And in fact, yesterday, in anticipation of this meeting, I had a quick call with all the Early Learning Coalition CEOs and executive directors. And I said, I have the chance to share with the committee. We're going to be talking about the CARISA. Give me the latest. And they said, we've had, as we always do, you know, we've had throughout the pandemic, classroom closures. But what we're not seeing, and this is the miracle of what these funds have done, are permanent closures. Like, permanent closures, yes, there's some of them, but there's classroom closures are common, but permanent closures have stayed relatively low, and some of the bigger districts that have compared to pre-pandemic, so far, it hasn't spiked up, and that is in part because these dollars have helped providers to be able to sustain their operations, which keeps all the sort of working. So I think it's just been incredibly successful. Here's another provider. These grants helped us increase hourly compensation by 28%, as well as providing for 2 weeks of vacation time, up from 1 week. So imagine that. You get a whole extra week off to spend with your family as a benefit that was funded by these provider grants. Again, just a huge way of a this is another one here. They talked about, you know, we replaced the rugs with new flooring to help eliminate germs. They've got additional cleaning supplies and a fogger and ozone and some of these things. So, you know, that healthy environment. But also, they were able to give raises and bonuses to their staff and say, what a joy to show my employees how much they're appreciated. And they go on and on. Here's, I'll stop with this one. It says, I initially gave all staff a bonus for staying on board. My staff have been with me for 10, 15, 20, and even 23 years, and most of them are still here. I've used these recent grant dollars for staff retention bonuses. These past 2 years have been very difficult, and the bonuses have made a difference for how everyone has been able to cope. So I just wanted to convey to you, you know, you can see a lot of, you know, big numbers in the budget, but in early care and education, it's just so impactful, and something like that extra week's vacation or, you know, a retention bonus, those things really make a difference for people that are thinking, I'm not going to cash the check when I get it in September. I'm going to wait until I can use it to do Christmas shopping. I mean, these are people just making those day-to-day decisions, and the appreciation you've shown, the support, has been really impactful. The final piece of this is, along with the Phase 6 grants, there were some initiatives, and I'll focus on the workforce initiative because that is the theme we're hearing, attracting people to the early care and education profession and then retaining those that are here are two challenges. And so this workforce initiative, and again, the Phase 6 grants have about 80 days ago is when those funds were released, and this workforce initiative requires each Early Learning Coalition to do a study to really look at their community and design the initiatives to attract workforce. But that is the one area where there's a significant investment that's right in line with what the greatest need is across the state. And so we're really excited about how that is shaping up. And with that, Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Chancellor. Members, are there any questions? Representative Lernan, you recognize?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Chancellor, for coming back and briefing us on all this. I own a small private tutoring company, so I am I'm not in the VPK space, but I'm kind of adjacent to some of these students. And coming from the owner side, I was hoping you can help walk me through some of the pots of money and what dollars went specifically to individual teachers, like what they applied for, what they got, versus what went to the owner of the companies in the form of stabilizing their operation. But also, like, for example, I know PPP loans were life-saving to me, but thousands of businesses in my district, I'm sure they were eligible for those as well. So can you just kind of like help me understand which pockets went to teachers and which pockets went to the owners?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Representative Lernan. Yeah, so I am definitely not an expert on sort of any of the pots of money outside of the funds that have administered through DEL. And it's in terms of the funds that have gone directly to the employees, the only funds would be that are coming to mind are the disaster relief payments, you know, those $2,000 checks that have been issued. There's lots of, like for some of the workforce initiatives, those are targeted and the way those, the amount of funds were estimated, it was for things like when somebody is applying and wants to work in an early care and education center, they have to get a background check. That comes with a cost and time investment. They also have to get the Department of Children and Families Health Safety training, which is, you know, 40 plus hours. There's a cost for that plus the time investment. So there's funds, and an example of that, Palm Beach County has like an Inspire program where they're just eliminating and every one of those barriers. So there's no cost. You can even get compensated for your time, for your first month's employment where you're doing getting the training. They're helping to offset those costs. So there's funds identified for like workforce barriers, but the funds, like the phase grants, those are going to the business owners who then have the flexibility. And as you see from the letters, a lot of them, because the workforce is an issue, are focusing on retention, pay raises, retention bonuses, adding benefits and that kind of thing. But there hasn't been, in our space, funds that an employee would apply for and get. But for anything related to training, whether it's college classes or getting your,
like a national credential for early care and education or associate classes. There are, through state-funded programs, all those options are, you know, are available. So I don't know, but in terms of like the loans and things from other programs, I'd have to do some research and get back with you on that.
Members, any other questions? Ranking Member Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate that. Good to see you, Chancellor. So you mentioned stabilization. One of the pots of money was for stabilization. And when you're talking about the workforce initiatives for the educators, I guess my question is just sustainability. So we're talking about the bonuses, but are we in a situation where these providers are able to, and they're doing things in various, you know, various owners are doing various things to retain their employees, right? So raising salaries, sustainability, how do we move with these pot of monies that we have? How do we help these providers sustain this in a sense of being able to raise the salary throughout the system?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. So the one of the things as I think about this is to just step back and think how early care and education is funded. The two ways the state does it, through state programs or state federal programs, the state program would be our voluntary pre-kindergarten, but of course that has broad participation. It's like, it's, you know, over 70% of eligible students participate in the program, but it's a three-hour program. So if a child is receiving early care and education all day, just 3 hours of that is covered. The other piece, school readiness, there's for children 0 to 5, there's roughly 136,000 children that receive services through school readiness. Again, not separating out the school age ones, but the 0 to 5. But if you look at how many children in Florida are that age, it's 1.36 million. So it's about 10%. So just something to keep in mind is whatever this committee does and the state does with its two big programs for the, I guess really for the 0 to 3, because when you get in the four-year-old, there's the VPK that's available for everyone. There's just a small percentage that are getting the subsidized care. So for that 90% that aren't in school readiness, that really does get down to the only way that those providers that serve the private pay families is going to be just, you know, raising their rates is the only way they'll have more money in the system. For those providers that contract with the state, whether it's VPK or school readiness, you know, the minimum wage is going up, that's a driver. But for those services, the only funding they get is what this legislature gives them. There's no other, for school readiness, we get the federal dollars we draw down, but the legislature decides. And so in terms of sustainability, the legislature certainly has these one-time funds. The longest window we have is the ARPA discretionary, and there we have till September of 2024 to use those. So that's 2 years and 9 months away. And so a great investment, of course, is in our workforce and infrastructure. But as you've said, the long term, by definition, one-time funding has, you know, is limited what it can do to have a permanent solution. But if we are able to help our current workforce, 75,000 people, get additional training, then once these funds are gone, we'll have a more skilled workforce. So that those workers, we invest in them, and they in turn have that lifetime of continued service using those increased skills. But so I hope that's helped, but I think you have put your finger on a really challenging problem of how we, for those that contract with the state, you know, the only way to get more money in the system is if the legislature appropriates additional funds for those programs.
Representative Williams, recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You spoke of additional training. There used to be a program years ago, when I used to be a provider, that the VPK and the readiness program, that they would partner together, and the employees that would like to invest in themselves, they would partner with them and make it happen, like, you know, three-way split partnership to make sure that they are increasing the workload of investing in the employee, plus having the opportunity for their children at that particular time to attend the VPK program in the school readiness. But that's been years ago. I want to know if that program still exists, and if not, is there anything that we could do to make it possible?
So recognize.
Let me start to answer and also get some help. I know there is, for example, the TEACH program is something that this legislature has funded with approximately $10 million a year, and that provides full tuition payment plus bonuses once you complete training. And so that through that program, as an early care and education professional, you can earn your two-year degree, your four-year degree, certificates. So those funds are available. There's also some counties that have, additional things that they've done even above and beyond that to be more generous. So there are, that's a big incentive for early care and education, is there are programs that provide access to continued education. There's also, as part of this disaster relief funding, there's the ability to designate early care and education workers as essential employees, and with that designation, then their own children could receive school readiness, subsidized child care, even if their income would otherwise exclude them. So that is a way, as it sounded like, if someone would go work at a center, their children could be at the center, and they would get the pay, and they would also qualify if they wanted to be take classes and that thing too. So does that answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Members, any other questions? All right. Thank you, Chancellor Mears. I appreciate it. I'd say one thing before you leave, just for something for the committee to think about, because I know Ranking Member Davis talked about the labor shortage issue. This is something that I've had the chance to talk to the chancellor at length about. It's very different from the K-12 space. Right, so to set a minimum salary for K-12 teachers is impossible in the early childhood space, because the vast majority of early childhood services are provided by private businesses. So what I know the chancellor has tried to do is to make sure we are pushing as many resources down into the providers as quickly as possible, knowing that the market's going to dictate their ability to actually keep their teachers enrolled. So I do appreciate everything you've done. If you think about it, our early learning budget on any given year is about $1.4 billion. And the Division of Early Learning has had the responsibility to figure out how to appropriate $3.5 billion in federal money. And it's kind of like, I've used this analogy a number of times, it's kind of like the movies Brewster's Millions, where you have all this money to spend, but you really have to make sure that you're doing it in a way that doesn't create ongoing recurring costs that the state is going to have to address in 2 or 3 years. So I think you have done it remarkably thoughtfully, and I want to just commend the fact that And I don't know if anyone on the committee knows this, but the chancellor and his team worked directly with the stakeholders across the state to make sure that the dollars were being invested in the way that the child care centers felt they needed to be invested. It was not something that the agency said, this is what we think is best. They brought together the family child care homes, the early learning coalitions, the child care centers, the school district to talk about how do you need these dollars to be best spent? And I know those are sometimes tough conversations. But you had them, and I think it's going to be hugely impactful for our state and for our children. So thank you, Chancellor.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for this opportunity, and hats off to the work group. That really was a wonderful effort to be a part of, and appreciate that very much. Thank you.
All right, members, we're going to go back to our last bill on the agenda, HB 497, Lee County School District, Lee County, by Representatives Persons Mullica. But the bill is going to be presented by our very own Representative Roach, who is a co-sponsor on the bill. Representative Roach, you are recognized to explain the bill.
Thank you, Chairman Alupas, and good afternoon, Chairman, Vice Chair Koster, Ranking Member Davis, colleagues on the committee. This bill is House Bill 497. This is a local bill, impacts Lee County only. My colleague, Representative Jenna Persons Mullica, is the primary bill sponsor. She is presenting a bill in another committee and asked me to present this on her behalf. I've also co-sponsored the bill. I am a member of the Lee County delegation, and voted unanimously along with the rest of the delegation at our delegation meeting to bring this bill forward. This bill would call for a referendum that would be placed on the November 8th, 2022 general election ballot to ask the voters of Lee County to decide whether the Lee County Superintendent of Schools should become an elected position directly accountable to the voters rather than remain a current appointed position by the school board. That's the bill. Mr. Chairman, happy to entertain any questions.
Members, are there questions of the sponsor? Ranking Member Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Rep. Roach, I noticed in your explanation of the bill, you said that a delegation voted unanimously. My question to you is, what is the position of the school board members, and how many school board members do you have in Lee County?
You're recognized, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative. We have a seven-member school board. Two of those members are elected at-large countywide. The other five members have single-member districts currently. I have not gotten any feedback, positive or negative, from the local school board on this issue, nor have I gotten any feedback, positive or negative, from the current superintendent. But I will tell you sort of the landscape in Lee County right now. Our superintendent currently is serving in an interim position. And as part of his contractual agreement that he signed is that he could not be eligible, could not compete for the permanent superintendent job. The Lee County School Board is currently engaged in a nationwide search to fill that position. So that may, I'm speculating a little bit here, but that may explain his disinterest in this topic. But I have not heard directly from any school board members, positively or negative, on the bill. And I would stress to the members of the committee, this is just for Lee County only. And this is not a directive that will switch the superintendent from an appointed to elected. It simply allows the voters to make that decision.
Representative Williams, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the current superintendent that you have in place, will they be able to apply to become the permanent superintendent?
You're recognized, Representative.
My understanding is that in his contract, he is not even eligible to apply to become the permanent superintendent. However, if this makes it to the ballot, Lee County voters decide to have an elected superintendent, certainly he would be able to run for that position.
Any additional questions, members? Representative Lerner, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative, for bringing the bill and presenting it. I guess in counties that have elected school board, elected superintendents instead of just elected school boards, can you speak to the dynamic between the board and the superintendent in those counties? Would it remove a check of accountability there? What's the best case? We obviously have counties that do both things, so why is it better for Lee County to do it this way and other counties do it a different way? What's sure. The best practice here?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Good question. So, yeah, I did a little bit of research into this. So of the 67 counties in Florida, the vast majority, 40 of them already have an elected superintendent. We have only 27 out of 67 that still retain the appointed power. And, you know, famously, it's been stated that states are the laboratories of democracy and each state doesn't need to do their own thing. I think the same is true of counties. Which are the local unit of government representing their constituents. Every county doesn't have to do it the same. I will tell you, I've spoken to members in the chamber from counties that have an elected superintendent and counties that have an appointed superintendent. And as you can imagine, there's mixed feedback. Some of the members have said that they are frustrated with the elected superintendent. Some say that they want to switch to an appointed. Some say that they're happy with the way it is, whether it's elected or appointed in their respective counties. I can tell you this. You know, in Lee County, Florida, over the last 2 years, and I'm going to speak for the other House members in Lee County, too, I think the number one issue, and it's not even close, that we've heard from our constituents on is frustration with the Lee County School Board and the superintendent. And I don't think that's isolated to Lee County, Florida, or Florida. I think it's nationwide if you see, you know, what's happening across the country. And you had mentioned in your question about it serving as a check or balance or whether it would or wouldn't. It is my opinion, having researched this issue, and I think it's the opinion of the Lee County delegation, that the current superintendent and other superintendents around the state and the country that are appointed by the board do not serve as an adequate check and balance because the school boards can sort of leverage their contract or their job over the superintendent to get him to implement policies or take positions that he normally would not take were he left to his independent judgment or reflecting the will of the voter. So I think by having a superintendent that's insulated from the board's whims of firing him or her, that superintendent will then be working directly for the people and would serve as a greater check on what may be considered or described as rogue school boards around the state. But again, I want to stress that this is just for Lee County. This would not impact any other county in the state of Florida. And this is an issue which our constituents and the elected representatives in Lee County feel strongly about. And as part of a procedural posture, it passed the first committee in the Florida House unanimously. It passed out of our delegation meeting unanimously. And I'll ask for your support today to let the citizens of Lee County make this decision at the ballot box.
Members, any additional Representative Learned, or question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick follow-up. And, you know, Representative Roach, I appreciate you championing home rule here. I wanted to give you an opportunity, because I understand the point you're making about the check, that the superintendent can't be overridden by an overzealous school board, as you put it. I just want to give you an opportunity to talk about the opposite, right? Like, can a overzealous superintendent exert leverage on the elected school boards as school board members as it pertains to the budget or something? Because, you know, they're elected by one countywide, but you got these school board members that are probably going to be elected in much smaller, more local elections. And I want to hear your thoughts on that.
You recognize.
Thank you, Chairman. Yeah, I'm happy to share some thoughts on that. Yeah, I think it could happen in a variety of different ways. Whether the superintendent is elected or appointed, I think that you can have instances where you have maybe stronger school board members in some counties and weaker superintendents, kind of like the strong mayor system that you have in some places. So I think that may be more of a unique feature of personalities on the board and the superintendent than any sort of systemic way that it's set up, because I've seen it happen, whether it's an appointed or an elected position. But I will tell you this, in the event that you have an elected superintendent who does maybe overstep their bounds or does something that is not in sync with either the school board or the electors that put him there, the people would have a voice here to vote against that person or vote for an alternative. So this is about giving the voters, particularly voters in Lee County, an option. And again, I just want to stress that this bill is not mandating or requiring an elected superintendent. It's simply going to put this on a ballot. The voters of Lee County can make their intentions known about whether they feel this should be an elected or appointed position.
Representative Nixon.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Roach, I have a question. So do you think that this could open up the possibility for the role of the superintendent to be merely a popularity contest as opposed to the most qualified candidate?
You recognize?
Thank you, Rep. Nixon. I think that's possible, and I think that certainly happens in every elected office, including many of the members of this chamber and others. Yes, I think that that's certainly a consideration that voters will make about whether they simply like a candidate or not. So, yes, I think that's possible, and I think that's possible in every electoral contest. But, again, I think the voters should be able to make that decision. And it's right, because right now the voters, the constituents that I hear from and my colleagues hear from, they feel frustrated by the fact that they believe the school superintendent is insulated from accountability to the voters and to the parents of children that attend Lee County schools, and they want a more direct voice on his or her selection moving forward.
You recognize Representative Nixon.
Thank you, Chair. So I heard you say earlier in regards to just overzealous school board members and things like that, but don't the voters have the option to get rid of those school board members the same way in which you're saying if they were to vote for a superintendent?
You recognize?
Yes, they do. And this would just expand the choice and the ability of the voters to make decisions, not just on the school board, but on the superintendent. Because keep in mind, too, that, the school board superintendent election may not necessarily coincide with the election or reelection of all the board members, which are staggered terms. So I think it'd be great to give the voters a choice in that representation every 2 years in voting for school board members and every 4 years for a superintendent. I just think this expands the ability of voters to have their voice heard and make that choice. And again, the voters of Lee County may disagree, and they may vote to keep an appointed school board member, as 27 other counties in the state of Florida have done. But based on the feedback that I'm getting from my constituents and my colleagues are, I don't think that's likely. But no, I understand the point that you're making.
Representative Hunchofsky.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Roach, I have a question. I'm trying to understand how an elected superintendent who's elected at large is a check on a school board where the composition is 2 at-large members and 5 single district members.
Explain it the best way that I can. But currently, the situation we have in Lee County, I feel and my colleagues feel that the board has exploited the interim nature of that assignment and previous permanent positions to get the superintendent to enact policies that are not popular with the voters, and then take a step back and use the superintendent for political cover. In other words, the board wants to take a politically unpopular decision, and instead of doing that, they force the superintendent to do it. The superintendent does it, and then when there's voter pushback, they can summarily fire the superintendent and say, we addressed that problem while they still have the unpopular policy in place. So I think there has been some gamesmanship going on, particularly with the Lee County School Board. That's the only school board I'm qualified to speak on in my county. And then also, I think a part of this, although not the principal reason for the bill, is the cost. So what happens frequently, and we've had a number of superintendents in Lee County that have been summarily let go, and the county had to pay out the remainder of the contract, which is very, very expensive for the taxpayers. And this has happened multiple times in Lee County, whereas if you have an elected superintendent who does something unpopular and he gets unelected in the next term, the taxpayers are not on the hook for continuing to pay that salary. So I think it also would be beneficial to the pocketbooks of the Lee County taxpayers as well to have an elected superintendent. But again, that's my opinion. But the voters in Lee County, I think, should have the ability to decide that for themselves.
You recognize it, Representative Hunchofsky.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Roach, I apologize, but I'm still trying to understand. Is the superintendent, he or she, able to override the elected school board and therefore a check? Or is the elected superintendent just a third at-large member and then an 8-member board? I'm just trying to understand those roles.
Thank you. Recognize.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Rep. No, I don't think the superintendent would be acting as an 8th at-large member of the Lee County School Board, because when you read the Florida Constitution, I mean, there are some distinctly different duties that the board members have and the superintendent have. So I look at it as the board is there to set policy and then the superintendent is there to execute the policy. And that's maybe an oversimplification, but the superintendent does have some discretion, a very wide latitude on how he implements policy. And the school board may have one idea of how that policy should be implemented, and the superintendent may have another idea about how that policy should be best implemented to serve the students and teachers. So that's where I think the check and balance would come in.
Representative Hunchofsky.
Thank you, Chair. Last question. I'm still trying to understand. So if the role of the superintendent is to implement the policy that the school board has directed the superintendent to execute, how is an elected superintendent the check when their role is to implement the policy directed to them by the school board?
You recognize.
Yeah, great question. I think when you look at the policymaking apparatus of the school board, the policies that they espouse may be very broad in general nature, such as keep schools safe, or put protections in place to best protect these students against the spread of infectious diseases. They may be that broad, and then the superintendent would have the latitude to actually design and implement measures to do that. And so I think the scope of duties for the superintendent is different from the school board. And the school board, if they intend to get detailed into the implementation of policy, certainly has the ability to do that in their directives, right? But if they don't, the superintendent will act in his or her discretion to implement the policy the way he sees fit. And that's where I think you could see some disconnect, and you have in some of the school boards versus the superintendents. And we saw that particularly this last summer in Lee County.
All right, members, any additional questions? Okay. We do have public testimony. Susan Delago, teacher, high school teacher, wishes to speak. You're recognized. I was wrong. I can hear you. But is the little button lit up? No.
So, do you, yeah, got it. I usually don't use a microphone. So my name is Susan DeLago, also DeLago. I am a 31-year resident of Lee County. I have been in the school system as an educator and as a parent for all of those 32 years, and I am currently a high school teacher. I have 10 years until retirement, so I'll still be around for a little while. I'm not sure why this is being proposed, but I would like to go on record as opposing it because I believe that the people in Lee County are better served by local control of their of our superintendent as he or she is appointed by the elected school board. So far, they've been doing a good job of keeping him or her in check, and I believe it's working for us. I don't see why we need to fix it.
Thank you, Mrs. DeLago.
Thank you.
And we have Melissa Francisco waving in opposition. Members, that concludes public testimony. Is there debate? Representative Duggan, you're recognized in debate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to speak on the check and balance issue. Where I see the virtue of the elected superintendent is really because of the nature of the school board. Most people assume that a school board is a legislative body. They think it's equivalent to a county commission or a city council. It's not. It's an executive body. School boards don't pass ordinances. They can put something on the agenda and pass it that night. There's no public notice requirement. What they pass out doesn't say at the top an ordinance relating to whatever. They are an executive body. They're a 7-person executive body. And I think just common sense will tell you, if you have 7 members who are each an executive, you have very diffuse accountability, and you have very opaque accountability to the public, because essentially, worst case scenario, every member of that 7-member body can just do this when it comes down to who's responsible, who made this decision, who let that contract, why are the funds that we appropriated to them not yet in the teacher's hands? The virtue of the elected superintendent is that the public has a focus of accountability and responsibility. They can look at that person who has an independent base of authority for decision making, and they can hold that person accountable in a way that is very difficult to hold the school board accountable. And I will tell you, in Duval County, we have a 7-member school board. All of them are elected by district, none at large. 2 members of the Duval County School Board have served a total of 8 years without ever appearing on a ballot. How is that? Nobody ran against them. They filed. They didn't draw an opposition. They never appear on a ballot. There's no accountability there. That person's not accountable to the public. That is why we need at least the option of an independent elected superintendent.
Members, any additional debate? Representative McCurdy, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's interesting because I also ran and never appeared on the ballot in my district as well as a candidate for state representative. And listening to the public testimony, my grandmother always told me, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And it sounds like it's working for the people of Lee County. So with that, I'm going to be down on this bill today.
Any additional debate, members? Ranking Member Davis, you're recognized.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. And again, thank you to the members of the public that decided to come and speak out on this bill. It really helps us hear from the members of the community as to where your stance is, and that's why I asked the question I did. My colleague from Jacksonville made the statement, a somewhat offensive, common sense tells us, and I was not in favor of that stance that we took in Jacksonville to elect our superintendent, because I have to say, like my colleague sitting to the left of me, we felt like many of us felt in Jacksonville, if it's not broken, do not fix it. We had the opportunity many years ago in Jacksonville to have an elected superintendent, and it was not a good experience in Jacksonville. We do now have a superintendent that has our school district in a situation where we are points from being an A district. And our superintendent was the Florida Superintendent of the Year and appointed superintendent. My personal feeling is this superintendent has been elected, because there's seven people that have been elected to decide who will be the superintendent. So whether the superintendent is elected by the voters or they're elected by the school board, they're still an elected person. So as you can hear from the conversation I've had, I will not be supporting this bill, and I am consistent with this because I believe that this person has already been elected, whether it's by the voters or by the school board that has been elected by the community. So that is what I have to say.
Representative Nixon.
Thank you, Chair. I want to also just echo the same sentiments that Rep. Davis stated. And just thank you all for coming and giving your testimony. I also want to kind of speak on what my colleague from Duval stated earlier in regards to someone not being on the ballot. The same thing can happen to someone running for school board. I feel if there's no opposition, they won't be on the ballot as well. So I think that point is null and void. But I think what it really boils down to, and what I'm fearful of as a parent of five, is that this superintendent position could potentially become it could create some political polarization, and that's something that we need to try to get out of the education system. And so, as you all can tell, I will definitely be voting down on this bill.
Representative Hunchowski in debate.
Thank you, Chair. I struggle with this because personally, I don't think a superintendent should be elected. And yet, coming from local government and speaking about the ability to vote and voters having a say, this is going to the voters. And that's where I struggle with this. I personally, if given the opportunity, would not be voting for an elected superintendent, because I have not heard where the check or the balance is. It does seem like it's setting up disagreements on the board. However, this is going to the voters, and what we are voting on is not whether or not the superintendent is elected. We are voting on whether or not the voters have the choice to make that decision. And therefore, even though I do not agree with an elected superintendent, I will be supporting the voters' choice to make that decision in their local county. Thank you.
Members, any additional debate? Seeing none, Representative Roach, you are recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, colleagues on the committee, for the robust and spirited debate. I appreciate it. I would just urge you to those who oppose the bill, to understand that this affects Lee County. And I would posit that I and the other elected representatives and senators who represent Lee County, we know and understand that county better than some of the colleagues who don't live there. So this only affects Lee County. And as Rep. Hunchowski so eloquently put it, this simply gives the voters a choice on whether that should be an elected superintendent or an appointed. It doesn't mandate anything. And then I think maybe I was remiss in not going a little bit deeper in detail into actually what happened this summer that predicated the filing of this bill, was that we had a school superintendent, interim appointee, issue what our Attorney General of the state of Florida determined was an illegal order. And he only rescinded that illegal order when he was threatened with potential removal from office by the governor. And that has led to, hundreds and thousands of people attending school board meetings in Lee County in protest of those orders that we have not seen before in the history of Lee County. So I would just say that again, this is the number one issue that we hear from constituents on in Lee County. We know those constituents, we serve them, represent them, and are acting in what we believe are their best interests and giving them the choice about whether this should be an elected or appointed position. I would urge for your support for this for the people of Lee County as a home rule champion. Thank you.
Representative Roach, having closed on his bill, Kirsten, please call the roll.
Representatives Caruso.
Yes.
Davis.
No.
DeSegli.
Yes.
Duggan.
Yes.
Hawkins.
Yes.
Hunchowski.
Yes.
Coster.
Yes.
LaMarca.
Yes.
Learned.
Yes.
McCurdy.
No.
Mooney.
Yes.
Nixon.
No.
Roach.
Yes.
Rodriguez.
Yes.
Trabulsi.
Yes.
Chunau is excused. Williams?
No.
Chair Lupus?
Yes.
13 yeas, 4 nays.
Members, by your vote, HB 497 will be reported favorably. Congratulations, Representative Roach. All right, members, that brings us to the end of our agenda today. I would just like to go on the record to say that nobody wished me a Happy New Year. So thank you for not listening to instructions from last year, but Happy New Year to all of you.
Happy New Year.
And with that, seeing no further business, Representative Mooney moves, we rise.